Computer, initialize holosuite.
So, welcome to yet another episode of The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I am your host, Perry, with my co-host,
David.
And we will be going over the episode today, A Man Alone, the second episode of the first season of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. But before all that, let's touch base here with each other. David, how's your week been? Since the last time we talked anyway?
It's been great. So as everyone should know by now, I'm watching The Next Generation while watching these episodes week to week from Deep Space Nine. And it's been fun because this last week I got to meet both the Cardassians and Keiko O'Briens for the first time, which were very important to this episode. If I had not watched those episodes from The Next Generation, I would have been a little bit lost. Or at least I wouldn't have known a few things like, you know, Keiko and the fact that she and O'Brien had a rocky relationship kind of from the beginning. And this episode touched on that a little bit more. But it was good to see those things kind of start to, you know, fill in my blanks, if you will, in preparation for this episode this week.
So if I'm not mistaken, that means that the episodes of Next Gen that you watched would have been what? Data's Day?
Data's Day. That's one.
That's where, and then the other thing I have to correct you, her name is Keiko.
Oh,
Keiko O'Brien.
My apologies.
Yes. you don't want to offend. Yeah, let's not offend anybody out there listening. He's new, so we'll give you a pass. I just want to say how envious I am that you get to watch all these things for the first time, and I've seen them so many times. I'm just like, super jealous. I wish I could be starting these over, you know. Okay, so yes, we do see you. So you got to see Keiko in the beginning, introduction of her character, and then you get to see her again here, and you see that, her and O'Brien are on the skids. So, before we get into that, just a quick update on myself. This last week has been really busy. I'm working all the time and trying not to, and it's amazing how when you're trying not to work a lot, it seems like you work even more. You know, so it's right. Just been like, let's figure out a way to, well, try to do everything. So, you know, sleep's obviously the thing that's not important. So I can just not do with that, you know, but I feel like we're getting there. I feel like hopefully by the end of this year, things will be at a much more, you know, stable pace.
Right.
And then we can, then I could do some other things.
Right. Yeah.
So. The episode, A Man Alone, the second episode of the season. It was actually the third episode filmed, but they switched the order and aired this one first. So the synopsis of the episode is pretty simple. As David indicated, we are seeing a lot of characters for the first time here. This is really still kind of like the season opener. We're getting used to the fact that Starfleet is in a new area. And so everybody's trying to cope with the new adjustments and all those kinds of things. The O'Briens are struggling with it. Keiko's feeling lost and out of place and with nothing to do on the station. The various children are running amok because they don't have anything to do. And, of course, we have Odo, our security chief, the constable, who spots a man in Quark's, our resident Ferengi's bar, and is somebody that he obviously had previous dealings with, and he is... adamant not be on the station anymore. He threatens him. They fight. Commander Sisko breaks him up. And then he basically just tells Odo that, hey, you know, the guy's not breaking any laws right now, so you can't do anything to him.
Right.
A little bit of time passes. This guy, whose name is Ibudan, by the way, is murdered. And then this launches them into an investigation. And the more they go through the investigation, the more it looks like Odo is our culprit. Odo is our guilty party here. This, of course, causes a lot of station unrest with the population. the Bajorans are kind of are very upset that this outsider, this alien shapeshifter being, is still running amok on the station when he's already murdered one of them. They're screaming for justice. We got the little riots going through the promenade and things like that. And basically, it's, you know, coming to a head to a point before good old Dr. Bashir discovers that it was a clone. And that this was all an elaborate setup to draw Odo out and to frame him. And they solve the murder. They arrest the real Ibudan because, hey, in the future, even murdering a clone is still murder. Yeah. And, yeah, that's it. Ibudan goes to jail. And Odo is vindicated. And the civil unrest and all that stuff kind of dies down. And we've now moved on. Now, again, that is a very short summation of the episode. If you want to watch it, if you haven't seen it, what are you doing? If you haven't seen it, like, go watch it. But yeah, that's it. So now we can get into some other stuff there.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna, now since I've talked so much, turn it over to David. David, what were your first impressions of this episode?
Yeah, so this episode is it's a typical episode. This one, I wouldn't say it's not as important to the story, I guess you would say, as the first episode, you know, that two-part season premiere. But the thing that really stood out to me is the way that this show is going to make a clear definition about who these characters are. And for me, the most direct comparison, of course, for Odo is to Data on The Next Generation. Just simply, each actor, you know, Brett Spiner and
Renee Auberjonois.
Sorry, I said that totally wrong. But anyway, you know, the two of them are having to play characters that are heavily made up, or at least their faces have a lot of makeup on. And, you know, Data, being a cyborg, is very, you know, straightforward. There's no emotion that Data gives off. He doesn't understand emotion. He can't experience emotion. That is not true of Odo in this episode. He is a emotional being. He is angry at Ibudan for breaking the law. He is the constable of Deep Space Nine. He is responsible for ensuring that laws are followed. And, you know, he, Quark is his kind of main enemy. You know, in this episode, he tells Quark, you know, if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be you're always on your toes because of me. And Quark says, you know, I'm a better villain. I'm a better thief because you put me in the position of working harder to stay out of your sight. So that means that Odo, at least in comparison to Data, that's my initial thoughts when I was watching this episode, is, you know, this is a character that is clearly different from just a simple comparison of Data. And this fact that he is an emotional being, it means that we're not going to be, you know, retreading old, you know, storylines from The Next Generation. We're going to be watching a character who is different. I mean, the idea that you'd be a shapeshifter, I mean, automatically you can imagine anyone would be upset or at least afraid of a being that could change its shape and its ability. It's going to hide as inanimate objects. It can appear, I would assume, as another person. So anyone would initially have fear or hatred for such a being. And that hadn't yet come up, you know, in just that first episode. But here it is. Yep, here's a character who would automatically inspire fear in other people. It would make sense that, you know, oh, this character would be very, it'd be very easy for them to commit murder if they decided to do so. If they can easily fit through cracks just by sliding through small holes and then murder someone and escape. Yeah, that's very easy to do. So the fact that Odo was the kind of main character of this episode, I thought was a good way to get to know him a bit better. He goes up to Sisko and says, you know, I'm in charge of the law around here. And just because, you know, the Cardassians aren't in charge and the Federation is, you know, the person who makes the laws, that's not always justice. Has to be dealt out, and I am committed to doing that. And yeah, he makes a clear stand of who he is as a character in this story and does a good job of doing that. And also, you know, he's afraid on some level. I mean, he doesn't express fear as, you know, trembling and running away, but, you know, his office is attacked and damage is done, and he has to initially just kind of look at those people who are forming a mob and just stand up to them. But when everyone else comes along and defends him, that's a great moment for them to say, hey, look, we got to have, you know, law and order here, too. Like, if you think he's guilty, we're not going to do mob justice here. So we're seeing a station that's recovering from the atrocities of the Cardassians and having to figure out how to go forward. And Odo is committed to expressing justice. And I look forward to seeing more of him do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I love that scene between the two of them, between Sisko and Odo, when Odo comes to Sisko's office later on after the initial run-in with Ibudan, and he's explaining, you know, that's his stance, that, yeah, laws change depending on who's making them. But I remember him saying, but justice is justice. Yes. And so, you know, he's kind of making that distinction there that, you know, there is, you know, at least in his opinion, there is an absolute right and absolute wrong. Murder is definitely one of those absolute wrongs, and a person should be held accountable for it, regardless of if you murdered a Cardassian or a human or whatever.
Right.
You know, and that's, and it's interesting that the person making that statement is the shapeshifter, the one who can literally change and be any of those things. He can look like any of them, you know? And so I also found that interesting because, yeah, again, here comes the mob that's after him, and he is once again, you know, he's being viewed as this outsider and this threat and this danger, but he's the only one who's really kind of upholding this very moral absolute here. Everybody else is kind of being very relativistic with their morals and what they are looking for, and he is kind of staying true to this path despite everything that it ends up costing him before they, of course, reveal the truth.
Right. You know?
So, also, again, we'll, I don't know how many times this is going to happen, but going to have to correct you again.
Oh, no.
Lieutenant Commander Data is not a cyborg.
My gosh.
He is an android.
Android. I can't believe I said that.
Yeah, there is a difference, and especially considering the Borg themselves that exist.
Yes.
Yeah, we got to make sure, again, people, don't try to hunt David down.
Oh my gosh, I can't even believe I said that. It's said so many times. I am not a robot, sir. I am an android. I am an android,
exactly. So, yes, but again, David's new. He gets a pass.
No, right? I everyone in the comments should, in every single way, make a point that I said wrong.
I fully expect that when this gets posted, to just scroll down and see like screams of Android, like all the way through. I really do. So that will be hilarious when that time comes. But yeah. So now back to Deep Space Nine and moving on. So, were there any, next question for you would of course be, are there any standout performances from the episode? Any character that presented themselves in this episode that really kind of, you know, just got you really into them all of a sudden for a second episode?
Well, Keiko in this episode is arguing with her husband, Chief O'Brien, about what they're going to be doing here on this station. She's not quite at home. You know, she's a botanist. What is a botanist going to be doing on Deep Space Nine? And when you first see them in this episode, they're arguing about, you know, what they're doing there. And they're doing it over dinner. You don't hear the direct debate initially. You don't hear what they're arguing about. But when you do get to get an intimate moment and hear them talking to each other, you see that they are... I mean, this is a true couple. You know, these are people who, when you're a couple, you have to be completely open and honest and express your frustrations and angers, but do so in knowing that the other person is going to still accept you at the other end of that debate and argument. And so when Keiko is trying to say, like, I don't have a place here, and, you know, but I don't want you to have to give up Chief O'Brien, she said to him, I don't want you to give up your promotion. And he said, well, you know, maybe I could move around. It doesn't necessarily mean I have to lose my promotion. She's like, no, you know, we're here. I just got to find something for myself, for me to do. And one thing I love to do with stories, again, I was an English major in college. And so one thing I love to do with stories is like pause and be like, okay, if I were writing this story, what would I tell the character to do next? And I was thinking it'd be great. You know, I thought maybe Keiko could be her concern was that she wouldn't be going out on ships into this new wormhole that's been found to the Gamma Quadrant. And, you know, explore new worlds, including botany. And Chief O'Brien said, well, you know, maybe we could get on one of those ships. If I had been there, I was like, oh, Brian, you should have told her, no, you're going to be the expert on all the things out there. You may not be the first one to be exploring, but when they come back through, they're going to talk to the first person they can about their revelations, and you could be the one who becomes the depository of all this knowledge that's being brought back. That was what I was thinking. That'd be fun for the character to be, and she could be this expert on all the things about the wormhole, and that could be maybe her role, as she's the one who works as like the scientific point person, if you will, on Deep Space Nine for things going on. Now, of course, as soon as I say that, you know, Drax is that character, but I guess, you know, she is the science officer, so that role is already taken on some level. But her choosing to be the school teacher for this space station that's having to host a variety of cultures was actually another really good suggestion. It's going to be fun to see her navigate these these minefields of various cultures and trying to explain what they are like to these kids, trying to raise them all, or at least be, you know, a teacher to them all, and do so in a way that brings them all together into a shared understanding of this, you know, space station and the world of Bajor. So she's going to have a fun job ahead of her. Whether or not we're going to see much of that, I mean, that won't be the most immediately fascinating stories, I imagine. But when we do see her, she'll have a role to play. And then, of course, Drax. We get to learn more about the Trill, if I remember that correctly, the Trill race. You know, we learn more about her relationship as Drax, you know, the being that has multiple hosts over time. And how Sisko knew the former Drax very intimately. In fact, was a father figure to Drax, or to Sisko, that is. And I think you had said last time we were talking in our last episode that we're going to learn a lot more about their relationship. And this episode really got there, because Sisko says that he knew the original Drax as a father figure, as someone they spent time together. But he's not romantically interested in Jadzia Dax, as opposed to Julian Bashir, who is interested romantically in Jadzia, and how that will, there's a little love triangle kind of thing going on. But, you know, Sisko makes it clear, look, I'm not romantically interested. It's the relationship I have with is very different than the one you're pursuing. And then Jadzia's makes the comment of, you know, we don't really go all that into, you know, sexual things. We're above all that. If the host feels an inclination, maybe. And Julian goes, he basically says the line, so you're saying there's a chance. And so it'll be fun to see how that relationship grows, because you don't fully, I mean, at least I didn't. I didn't fully believe Sisko's denial, like, oh, there's a beautiful woman who also inhabits the personality of someone who I loved on a certain level. Now, on some level, I get it. If you knew this person as an old man, and now this person has been reborn as a young, beautiful woman, I can imagine that that would cause all sorts of, you know, conflicting emotions. But, I mean, but this way, I wouldn't be surprised if Sisko and Jadzia end up together on some level. But right now, they are clearly saying that's not the relationship.
Yeah,
and Julian's the one who's trying to get in there and say, hey, you know, I've been interested in you from the first moment we met. I've got, you know, that, the champagne, I think he said, ice. So,
you know, he definitely, to me, in watching this, he kind of comes off a little stalkerish. You know, when the episode opens, she's in the holodeck. She's trying to, you know, enjoy herself. She's playing some game, and he just walks in and he's just like, hey, I'm here, you have to deal with me, you know?
Right.
And it just goes on throughout the episode. He's always just kind of like popping up, and he's around her, and he's definitely just not picking up the hint that she's just not interested. Now, some could say that, you know, they were just kind of playing that coy game, you know, whatever. But I mean, at the same time, at some point, I feel like you just got to accept the person's statement and just be like, she's not interested, dude. Move on. And so a couple of things. Like, one, again, that opener where they're playing that game with the bubble. And she says that the the game responds to your brain waves, and that what you have to do is
get it to be one consistent color.
Right, you have to make it a color. So I found that interesting that she was playing this game, considering the fact that she is a trill, a joined species, and she's got multiple different, you know, thought patterns that all kind of are an amalgam into her, right?
Right.
So it's just like, wouldn't this be an impossible thing for you? Because you're essentially, yeah, you have multiple different kinds of brainwaves. So maybe it's like an ultimate mastery thing, like to be able to control it for her. But I just feel like, and she even makes the comment, like she's been trying to do it for like 150 years or something. And it's just like, okay, well, you're 300 years old. You've been doing it for 150. So half of your life you spend playing this game and you still haven't gotten it right. I say, you get an A for colossal waste of time. Like, way to spend. I mean, you spent 150 years and this is the best you've got. Come on.
As soon as Julian even tries, he immediately fails. So at least she was able to get something accomplished.
I mean, I guess so. I mean, that's a good takeaway, I guess. But I'm just like, man, again, when I heard that, I was like 150 years on something that probably your species would never be able to master anyway, because of the fact that you're a joint species. You have at least two different brainwaves going on, because there is, they make that distinction that the symbiont, the Dax part of her, does have its own, you know, there is a little bit of communication between them. It's not like an entity of its own, you know, or anything like that, but there is a neural connection, which shows that there would at least be some differential there, because that maintaining that connection, that sync, is very important.
Right.
So yeah, I'm like, okay, well, you're at least two different things. You're never going to be able to master that.
Right.
And yeah, so then, yeah, of course, Dax is she's our science officer. So yeah, you were talking earlier about, you know, O'Brien was talking about the ships going through the wormhole and exploring and bringing back samples of things. Yes, for the most part, Dax would be the one that would be handling that. But there's absolutely no reason that Keiko couldn't as well. And I thought the same thing when I first watched it. I was just like, yeah, Keiko, like, you don't need, like, why do you want to go? Because she makes the statement to O'Brien, yeah, they'll be going through the wormhole, but I'll be staying here. It's like, why do you want to go? Like, no one knows what's over there. Let them bring it back. Let them risk themselves. Like, you're a wife and a mother. You're a part of a growing community. You've got a lot of things that depend on you here. You get all the benefits. They're going to bring the stuff to you. And it's safe, it's secure, and you get to do all kinds of experiments on it. Yeah, head that up. Do that. Be the cornerstone botanist in the beta quadrant or whatever. But no, she just, that wasn't good enough, you know. So but then, of course, they get to school. And, as you said, you know, Sisko even reminds her, hey, you know, I can't force these other people to bring their kids to you. And you're going to have a quagmire there to make your way through, because you've got to come up with a curriculum that not only caters to all of the different kids in the Federation, but also the children of this new planet that we're orbiting and their provisional government, and trying to bring all of the stuff of the Federation to them as well. So there's a lot you're going to have to unpack here and deal with, and we don't know what the fallback is going to be. So are you sure you can handle it? He's asking her.
Right.
And, yeah, just even now thinking about it, I remember watching that and just being like, yeah, that's not going to go well. Like, that's not going to end well at all. So can't wait to see, of course, what happens next with that. But also with, you know, back to our other storyline of the murder.
Yeah.
Right? So while all this is going on with O'Brien, which one last thing I will touch on the O'Briens. I think that they do a great job with that couple in demonstrating them as like a real couple, you know, like they drop away all the Trek and the sci-fi and all that kind of stuff. And you get a real couple that's, you got two dedicated professionals, obviously in vastly different fields, but they still want to be useful and do their jobs. And clearly O'Brien is a needed person around the station. He can't just leave. It's not just that it's a promotion, but he's valued. They, you know, even as they're talking about it, at one point he gets called away because only he can solve this issue that happens, you know?
Right.
So yeah, you've got these two dedicated professionals who have worked hard, who have trained, who have all these certifications, and suddenly, you know, she's in a position where she can't do the thing that she's been trained to do. So it makes perfect sense that this would make her feel out of place,
right?
Useless, and, yep, you know, wanting to find use again. So
right.
I think they do a great job of showing them dealing with that, working through it, from the arguments to, you know, the apologies to the finding ways to compromise, and, you know, her exploring things on her own and finding a solution on her own, and right, and O'Brien fully supporting her. You know, he doesn't right. stand in her way. He's not like, well, just be home. Like, what's such a big deal? Like, none of that. He is just there to, like, listen to her and comfort her and then support her with right. the decision that she makes. So once again, I think they did a great job of showing a very progressive, forward-thinking couple and not falling back on any kind of, like, old TV tropes of, well, you should just be the housewife and raise the daughter and stay in our quarters and no one see you ever. No, he's just like, you know, instead he kept trying to come up with solutions, you know, be a botanist, grow and make an arboretum, plant plants yeah. all over the place, you yeah. know, whatever it is you want to do.
On that point, I had to say it was funny when he's saying you could, you know, what's the central area called?
The promenade.
Promenade, there we go. And he says to her, ah, look, the promenade could use some plants. And, like, they look over, and someone's touching a dead plant.
Cisco, little Jake Cisco.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, I didn't realize that's what he was touching for, like, the longest time. I didn't know what that was.
Right, well, but as soon as you catch it, you realize there are dead plants. And she doesn't go, you're right, I should. She's like, nah.
Right. She's like, ugh. Right.
But on that point, actually, so you were saying, you know, she takes a role, you know, she's not just a housewife. But, you know, if you think about it, you know, in America, the idea of the frontier, the, you know, the settlers going out and, you know, making new towns, you know, the idea of the schoolhouse was very important. And it was usually women who had to teach the students, and those women had to teach all kinds of ages. So in this case, not only does she have to teach students of varying ages, she's going to have to teach students of varying cultures, and not just cultures, but alien cultures. So, yeah, it takes that idea of, you know, the next frontier to the next level. Here is a place where students are going to have to learn on the frontier, and where Julian Bashir is all like, ah, I get to go to the frontier and be a doctor on the front lines and experience adventures. Here's Keiko doing a traditionally, you know, women have, like I said, women taught in the schoolhouses back in the day, and here she is, almost filling that role in space on Deep Space Nine. So, yeah. Now, one thing I thought was pretty cool about this episode too was how Quark interacted with Odo. The idea that he was both the only friend of, and the, you know, ultimate villain to Odo's, you know, personality
situation,
you know?
yeah
there, when Odo is being maligned by the people in the bar, Quark goes up to them and says, you're wrong, that's not who Odo is. Odo is not a murderer, he is just in his way, even if it was a Cardassian that was murdered. And yeah, so I mean, so far Quark has only been the, I don't know how to put it. I mean, he's not the villain exactly.
I always used to call him the insidious character.
Right.
Nothing he's doing yet has totally been terrible or negative, but right. he's just got that kind of oily personality about him that you just right. know that he's doing something shady, whether exactly. you see it or not. You just know he's up to something.
Right. Yeah, he's a character who, I mean, he's fully part of this cast. He's fully part of the story. He's going to be there just as much as anybody else. But, you know, for example, The Next Generation, all of the characters are just one big team doing things episode to episode. To have a character who is on some level antagonistic to our otherwise main cast as a permanent part of the cast is going to be a wrench in that formula that actually will be, you know, it's like oil and water don't mix nicely, but that'll make for more interesting things than just water or just oil. We got some curious interactions we'll see. And this was that episode to see that really start to play out. He goes to Odo and he taunts him. He he makes fun of him. He says, you know, I'm just a better crook because of all you've done. I don't regret or repent of anything that I've been. But in the same episode, he also defends Odo in a unique way. So
I have to admit, I hated the Ferengi for like a really long time. Like, you know, the first time I ever saw him on Next Generation, I just don't like them.
Right.
And so, of course, coming into Deep Space Nine, that was like one of my, as soon as I saw the word Ferengi, I was like, oh, God, I'm going to have to deal with this, you know. But in this scene, especially the one you're talking about, where everybody's kind of like in hushed tones in the bar and talking about Odo being this terrible being, creature thing, and for Quark to say what he says, you know, and it did add a level of complexity to the character that I wasn't expecting. And then on top of that, you know, I love the ending because the guy was like, why are you, you know, basically he's like, why are you saying these things? I thought you were his enemy. I thought y'all were enemies. And right. He's like, yeah, so I guess that means I'm the closest thing he's got to a friend. And right. So he's, and it's like his perspective kind of got them to calm down and de-escalate, at least for a little bit.
Right.
That one Bajoran guy, I'm trying to remember what his name is in the episode, who's kind of like the main instigator of everything.
Is it Lemonet-S? I'm looking at the cast list right now. I don't know if that stands out.
No, I think that's from something else.
Sure.
I'm trying to think of what... excuse me. Can't think of what his name is right now, but I hated his face. Like, every time I saw him, I was just like, God, I just want to punch you right across the chin. Like, you know?
Yeah.
And, they were nicking those jokes. Oh, well, yeah, how do you kill a shapeshifter? How do you hang a shapeshifter? You know, like, that moment right there when I saw him, I was like, ah, you right now, I would punch so hard in the face.
Yep.
So of course now we come up to, you know, Odo's doing the investigation again. He's looking more and more like a guilty party. Julian, our intrepid doctor, finds some unknown material that he for some reason decides, hey, let's grow this in the lab. And it basically goes from like a few little scrapings to this massive thing in a tub, and we are watching it in rapid succession get bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, before they finally reveal, oh, I know what it is. It's a clone, you know? And, that's what Ibudan was doing, and how it's a whole elaborate setup that he's got this clone that he murdered just to try to frame Odo for his murder.
Right.
You know? Very interesting take on cloning, for sure, because especially the ending line there from Odo with, you know, yeah, it may have been your clone, but murdering a clone is still murder. So you're going to jail.
Yep.
And this brings me, of course, to my first 1990s cultural reference. Because woo-hoo! In the 90s, we had the cloning of Dolly the Sheep. Dolly the Sheep was cloned and born. Cloned and then eventually born on July 5th, 1996. Okay. So just a couple of, you know, years. I was going to say a couple of years into the 90s, but it obviously was the mid 90s, you know. So obviously the talk of cloning and the preparing for actual cloning and all that stuff had been in the news for quite some time, long before Dolly was actually successfully cloned in birth. There had been many attempts, most of them had failed, and then Dolly was eventually this first successful clone. Dolly died, by the way, in 2003, for those of you who didn't know. Dolly the Sheep is dead. But anyway, since in the 90s we were just beginning to really talk about and seriously look at the science of cloning, now to jump forward into the 24th century where we're seeing the full implications of cloning, that they've reached a point that with cloning, it's essentially still treated as a person. They have rights. You can't murder a clone. So that kind of leads to the assumption that a clone has the same rights as any other person. Right. Which, again, culturally, if anybody has ever looked into the whole thing about cloning and the moral implications of cloning, that was always going to be a concern. Does a clone have the same rights as the individual they're cloned from? Or just as any individual in general? Right. There's everything from, I've seen arguments that talked about, like, well, it's essentially the same thing as twins, but it's not. Because, of course, because of the way in which we do cloning, at least right now, one, cloning isn't instantaneous. That's science fiction, totally. And obviously, whatever they're cloning typically has already reached full maturity.
Right.
You know, so if, like, they were to clone me, for example, they'd be, if they cloned me, it would be given birth to basically baby me, but I'm already here as a full-fledged
right
adult, right? So
right.
That was kind of one of the distinctions there. So
the experiences of the clone you would be totally different from you.
Exactly. And it wouldn't be the same as twins, because twins are born simultaneously, you know. So
right.
And even though they have divergent experiences, the fact is they were still, I guess, you know, arrived at the same time is the point. So
right.
That's why it wouldn't be the same.
Right.
So I did like seeing here that Star Trek, of course, is always trying to make a statement about something. And it's kind of like a very, in a sense, kind of underhanded way of saying, yeah, everybody has rights. Because everybody was on board with arresting Ibudan and punishing him for the murder of his clone. Like, so it was clear that everyone involved considered clone murder, murder.
Right.
Right. So, as we are looking at this, have you ever thought about cloning at all? Like, I mean, not like cloning yourself, but like, again, more the, I guess, more like, again, the implications of cloning, like what could be done with it. Would you be interested in being cloned?
Personally interested in being cloned? I mean, I guess if the argument is that, you know, like a twin is effectively the is a totally different person, but, you know, grows up with you, but as the example you just gave, the person that would be born again, you know, if someone was born with my DNA, I mean, I wouldn't want that on a certain level, in the sense of, like, I think we have, you know, the reason men and women get married is to have kids, so to clone someone would be effectively useless on some level. But, you know, in most science fiction stories, what that comes down to is, how does the person who's being cloned get treated, as we've just seen. So for example, in the film The Island, that movie, the idea is that these clones are just being cloned so that their organs can be harvested, and they don't know it until they are told they can get to go to the island. You're saved, you go to the island, and the island is actually death, and your organs get harvested for your original, if you will. So personally, I mean, if someone found my DNA and made a clone without my knowledge, and again, that person was raised separately from myself, I would be more curious, actually, to see how my clone would live life separate from my own experiences. Like, how much am I me, and how much is
the environment?
Yeah, how much is, yeah, the nurture versus nature question.
Okay.
And so on a personal level, I mean, I'm not opposed to the idea, in the sense of, like, I wouldn't, if that person existed, I wouldn't, you know, like, begrudge them their existence, but I wouldn't go out of my way to make a clone of myself necessarily. How about you?
Yeah. So yeah, that was an interesting way of phrasing that. Like, you basically, if someone decided to clone you without your knowledge, you're okay with it. But you actively participating in your own cloning, no. And then also, if someone did make a clone without your knowledge, you said you wouldn't begrudge their existence. So you'd be okay with the clone continuing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Continuing to exist. Okay.
Well, if they are truly an autonomous human being, which I would believe they are, then yeah, they have any right to exist as every other twin has the right to exist compared to their twin. So,
well, for me, I'm going to say no. If the cloning, if the cloning was, I guess, a bit more instantaneous, and I could, I guess, interact with another adult me in short order, you know, mm-hmm. not essentially like, because the way we do it now, essentially, I could be cloned and someone could give birth to new me, and I could raise myself,
right?
You know, the way that we do it now. I don't want that. I think that would be really weird, you
right.
know? if someone cloned me without my knowledge, I'd be very upset.
Yeah.
If
Oh,
I
yeah.
found out that it had happened, I would just be very upset. Would I want to kill the clone? The enlightened answer is no. But the petty answer is depends on how close to me they are. Like, how much like me are they?
Right.
If they're too much like me, then they gotta go. It's gotta be destroyed. I am enough for the world. We don't need another one.
How true a statement has ever been said.
So yes, thank you. But yes, but if they were sufficiently different, like could meet my satisfaction for being different from me, then no. I think it'd be the same thing. Kind of just think of it more of like a twin. You know, we look alike. We may sound alike, but we're clearly different people. So yeah, it'd be an interesting, you know, nature versus nurture scenario. But, you know, you brought up the island. I think that we see a lot in science fiction, especially if you look at science fiction that did start to develop in the mid-90s and moving forward, that a lot of times whenever they talk about cloning, it's cloning gone awry, cloning gone wrong, right? Or that
right.
there is somebody who is like maybe promoting it as a good thing, but ultimately the deeper into it you look, the darker it is, you know?
Right.
So I think it's interesting that the moral arguments about cloning that were taking place as long before Dolly was actually birthed, but as the science was leading up to Dolly, they certainly played out in, you know, kind of that sensationalized horror side of science fiction, you
right.
know? So yeah, the island was a perfect example of that. And there's another sci-fi show that was also out in the early 90s called Farscape that briefly dealt with cloning, and their cloning was not only instantaneous, but it was true duplication of the cloned individual. Their memories, their thought patterns, feelings, everything. And I remember the episode that they did it, and in fact, the guy that did the cloning, the mad scientist, he was like, no, it's not a clone, it's a double. I doubled you. Everything about you is doubled in the other one. So, so then it was, you're dealing with, you know, two in every single way, not just in appearance and physiology, but in every way, they are the exact same. And I thought it was great because there's like a scene in it where the two, they're obviously trying to distinguish between themselves which one is the real one. So they start playing rock, paper, scissors against each other. But because, again, they're exact, they're doubles, they're getting it every time. And they're matching every time. So it's a stalemate every time. Great, great filming, but also great for, like, if you were wanting to have that kind of argument again about the ethics of cloning and what it can mean and everything else, great way to show that, you know, these two are indistinguishable. You know?
On the level of pure storytelling, I'm always concerned with the idea of cloning and when it comes to storytelling, because it's very easy to be a crutch of like, oh, this character died, but they're not dead. They have a clone. Like, that's what Star Wars recently did with, like, the Emperor. I'm like, okay, I mean, there goes the original trilogy in terms of what it meant. The idea that there is cloning, and remind me if I'm wrong, I don't remember so far in The Next Generation having seen any clones up to this point. So we did. Yeah?
We did. Early on, season two, Dr. Pulaski and Riker are cloned. When I believe it's called The Long Ladder or Up the Long Ladder or something like that. And it's where the Enterprise encounters the two civilizations. The one, they're like kind of backwoods, hickish, seemingly of Irish descent individuals.
Right.
And then you have the other side of them who they're all refined and scientific, and they already have been clones.
Right.
And they're getting ready to suffer a catastrophic failure of their society because they need new DNA.
That's right. No, I'm remembering now. The more you're talking, I'm looking at the synopsis now. You're right. In that episode, they were cloned against their will.
Yeah.
And they kill their clones right then and there. Actually, right. They follow your line of logic in Yeah.
Now there's
enough Riker and Dr. Pulaski for the world, the universe.
Yeah.
It's just like there's enough Perry for the universe.
Now, they do make the distinction there that the clones hadn't been alive yet. They were still inside their containers. You know, they hadn't actually drawn breath, you know, and they killed them, vaporized them before that could happen. Right. So that is kind of one of those situations where the consistency of Trek and its message don't match up. Because again, in TNG, it seems like if you clone someone against their will, we can phaser them out, right? Whereas in Deep Space Nine, it's like, you started the cloning process. They're an individual, so you can't, and we're going to arrest you for their murder.
Right.
You know? So, there was a clear distinction there. But, again, it's just nice to see that, you know, there was this consistency of thought here. They're taking something from contemporary time, again, the cloning of Dolly the sheep, and they're bringing it forward into the sci-fi realm and expanding on it so that we can access it and think about it and talk about it, which is exactly what Star Trek has done with so many different things over right. time, you know.
Gotcha.
So we're coming up here close to our end. But I just want to ask you real quick, two questions. What was one thing you really liked about the episode and then one thing you really disliked about the episode?
Oh, I don't know if there's any dislikes. There's nothing that stood out as something I disliked. I mean, I guess, let me ask you this. So are you talking about disliked as in, this part of the episode I didn't like, or is like there a character or like there's a thing that I'm like, I don't want that character to go away, or what do you think?
Anything. Whatever. It could be a character. It could be a setting. I hate it when they walk past this room. It's ugly. It's whatever it is. Right. And the same thing goes for something really cool that you like. I like the lighting. I like the way the computer display read, or whatever it is. You know, if there was one thing that just kind of stands out in your mind as a true positive to you and a true negative to you.
All right. Well, I'll start with the negative, I guess, just because it's, you know, it's fun to start negative and then go positive. The idea that, again, you know, because I'm making so many comparisons to The Next Generation simply because I'm watching that concurrently with this show. And so, you know, the Enterprise is shown as a bright, shiny place. Mm-hmm. You know, it's bright and beautiful even. And then Deep Space Nine is on a dingy, darkly lit, using the terminology you just used, set for this show. And part of me is like, I want the brighter atmosphere back. And you know, it's just like, I have to get used to the fact that, at least for now, I mean, maybe the show will gain a brighter, you know, set, who knows, but at least for now, nope, we're on a different situation. This is not the pretty Enterprise. So that's, I guess, the only negative thing I would really say. Everything else, I mean, I would say this episode didn't come off to me as like, oh wow, like this was a great episode. It was good, but like, no, nothing. I mean, the first episode was really good, you know. Oh man, yeah. Sisko had to overcome an emotional storyline, and you know, he had emotional growth through the episode. This one didn't have so much of that. We just learned more about who the characters are and what goes on. The thing I liked the most, I mean, I think just learning more about who these characters are in comparison to each other. I mean, that's always what's interesting about shows. And again, yeah. You know, like Quark with Odo. And one thing I haven't mentioned is, you know, Kira, when Kira was confronted with the idea that Odo might be guilty, and she's like, oh, he's not, like 100% not.
Yeah, she was already, totally, nope.
He's on his side, and that was interesting because we haven't, I mean, we know that they've worked together, but we haven't seen them really interact too much. So
yeah.
You really get a sense that, no, these two characters, they know and trust each other completely, and this challenge of their relationship survived that test. She didn't question him at all.
Yeah, she didn't even like flinch when the guy said it. She was like, there's no more, and I believe her exact words are, there's no more honorable person than Odo,
right?
You know, or I think she says than the constable, but right. You know, whatever. Yeah, you're right. It clearly highlights the two of them. You know, there is a connection there. There is a obviously a deep earned trust, and she is backing him 100%. And even when you know, the evidence seems to lend itself more and more towards Odo being the guilty party, she still never really comes down on Odo as a potential suspect, you know. She's just like, no, she's confident that there is something else that's going on there,
right?
What for me, one thing that I really love about the episode, and I think I'm in like kind of a rare class with this. It's I feel like this episode has a lot of that period film noir aspects to it. You know, with the way that it starts and the way that we see, you know, Odo when he's in the bar with Quark, right? And he's monologuing about the O'Briens and their fight, right?
Right.
And so here we have our titular hero, basically, the beat cop who is watching life around him, and he's in a seedy bar, and there's, you know, gambling going on in one corner. You've got the lovers quarreling over here, and here he is kind of sitting in the whole, you know, mix of it, right? And giving
Right.
his big speech, which I, again, I loved. I just love that feeling, the pacing of the whole episode. It makes it feel like, you know, that's what the goal they were going for. And maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. I didn't find anything online that said that it wasn't, but that was always the vibe that I got from it. And it's one of the reasons that Odo tends to be a favorite character of mine. Now, to everybody listening, yes, I'm going to say favorite character a lot during the run of this show. So just bear with me, all right? Everybody's a favorite. They have reasons. But yeah, Odo is definitely the standout for this one for me.
So I want to catch that again. Are you saying Odo is your favorite character on Deep Space Nine?
I'm going to say he is a favorite. He is not my
Is
favorite.
a favorite. Okay, gotcha.
He is a favorite, but he is not my favorite.
Okay,
So,
gotcha. So I was about to start watching this show with that in mind. Like, Harry likes Odo. Why should I look? I should look for that and figure out why.
Well, to that end, you should watch it with there's only one character I truly hate on this show. Everybody else, I have found something about them that even when they're nasty, I still like them. But there is one that I don't care if they're nasty, if they're nice, whatever it is. I'm just like, nope. And it's hard for me to not skip the episode when this person comes on because I hate them so much.
Oh, when they come
So,
on, so they're not on yet.
oh man, I gave it away.
I was gonna guess. I was
They're
gonna say let's have a guessing game, but I think I might that might not work.
They're not on yet, but oh man, when they come on, just like, oh, whew, all right.
Okay. Well, I'll be curious to keep an eye out.
But yeah, so well, we have things to look forward to then. So there we go. So again, just remind me that what you didn't like, and then what did you say you did like?
Just the getting to know the characters a bit more. You know, this was a character or an episode about figuring out who these characters are, comparison to each other, their relationships, like Quark with Odo and Kira with Odo, and basically most of these character interactions with Odo directly, but then also the O'Briens. So.
Okay. All right. Okay then. Well, we're going to see a much more of that. That is definitely not going away anytime soon. We will be back next week to talk about the next episode, which is Past Prologue. Now, again, remember that the order of these episodes was switched. So when this show first dropped, we had The Emissary was one and two, obviously, and that was the pilot. Then A Man Alone was next, even though it was not filmed next, it was dropped next, and then Past Prologue. So we'll be watching Past Prologue and then back here to talk about it. All right.
Great.
So catch us next week. Also, just real quick, for those of you that want to join in or have any questions, comments, concerns, want to correct David for the many, many times that he got someone else's name wrong
Please
or anything
do.
like that, you can catch us on our Facebook page, our Twitter page, various social medias. They're all there. Facebook, Twitter, the YouTube stuff should be coming soon, so stay tuned for that. But it's all the Fire Caves. Just search the Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast, and you will find us, okay? So join in, give us those questions, give us that feedback, and we will definitely address it. In fact, in a little bit, we'll start going through those things, and probably around, I'd say episode 5, we'll start going back and we'll have a Q&A of what you guys have been posting. All right? If there is stuff that's been posted. Okay? So to that end, we are at the end of our show. Guys, we're just going to say have a good one. David,
All
you
right.
want to close?
Yeah, thanks again, guys. This is the Fire Caves, a Deep Space Nine Star Trek podcast. Thanks again. Bye.
See you later.
This show is brought to you by Holosuite Media. Computer, list other available Holosuite Media programs.
Loading Holosuite Preview Program 4, Beyond Farpoint, a Star Trek The Next Generation podcast.
And Picard's the other character trying to solve the mystery. So he leaves for that reason alone. It could be, and it could really be any character. Any one of the main cast members could have gone with Data and been there with Data several days later trying to solve what happened to the Enterprise. It's very, very much a kind of a plot reason and nothing more, I think.
Yeah, I kind of wish Data had stayed on the ship, actually, because I would like to have seen him regress to a pocket calculator.
Loading Holosuite Preview Program 4, The Sci-Fi Feminist, a feminism and pop culture podcast.
I think I binged the first season of Discovery in one weekend. I was so blown away because for the first time, we see this diverse crew consisting of an Asian female captain, played by Michelle Yeoh, of course, who's one of my favorite actors, and various other characters of color on the bridge crew. And then most significantly of all, of course, is that for the first time in Star Trek history, we see a black woman, Michael Burnham, as the main protagonist.
Computer, deactivate Holosuite.